Good morning, January 14th, 2021, week 84 of this year, as far as I can tell. We're here today with Rosano, and I'm actually just going to hand it straight off to him to introduce himself. So, hello, welcome. Who are you? Hey. Where are you?
Hey, Boris. Thanks so much. I'm super excited to be here and to talk to you all, everybody here. I am... Rosano. I am in Brazil right now, but I'm actually Canadian. So technically my home base is in Montreal, but I've been traveling a lot last few years. So I've been out of the country. And I've been here for about a year now and I feel really good here. So I'm just going to keep hanging out. And I'm working a lot on tech projects, mostly like web stuff, web apps. I was doing iOS apps for about 10 years. And then in the last few years, I started to get more interested in like federated systems, web, open, decentralized things. And just exploring that stuff now. And we'll probably talk about all that today.
Awesome. Where in Brazil?
Right now I'm in the capital, which is Brasilia.
Oh, nice. We've got a couple of folks. So Helder, where are you?
I'm in Campo Grande. It's a bit of west to Brasilia, but it's closer than São Paulo.
Campo
Grande are both. Yeah, I'm in Brazil.
Oh, cool.
And they're both in the center west of the country.
And we've got a couple of other folks who are part of the extended Fission family. Bruno is in São Paulo. He's done all of our character illustrations. And Caleb is also he's a student in IT and has been really pleased with a lot of the kind of tech stuff that Brooke really works on, so he's been very early. So we've got, I'd say, outside of Germany, Germany and Brazil are our two sort of like mini communities where we can say, oh yeah, there's like six people in Brazil who know about Fission.
That's crazy. I had no idea, actually. I thought I had some awareness about your team, and it's, didn't know that, but that's really cool. That makes me happy to know that you have this Brazilian.
I think that's sort of useful to start. So I'd love to, are you doing paid work for other people, or you work on your own projects? Like,
no, I've actually just always done independent stuff. I've never had a real job, I have to say. I've never actually like worked in a company or in the industry. I've actually been really kind of outside of the industry most of the time, so I've been working on like my personal projects, iOS apps, and now I'm doing like personal projects on the web, and I've just always done that, and I was making like enough money to get by, and that was enough for me. So I'm just 100% doing that stuff now.
Amazing. So let's talk about, I think when we first sort of, you bumped into Fission, I started seeing you around, cause I run the like Fission Twitter account and stuff like that, you've got this, zero data apps, project list. What is it? You tell me.
Yeah. It's sort of, it's like a response, I guess, to this habit in the tech world of like naming things by their technical function, which is useful and clear to like people who are technically oriented, but trying to explain what, for example, this word unhosted, I work a lot with remote storage, which is like a open protocol for per user data storage, very similar to Fission. And that sort of came out of the unhosted movement. Unhosted means that it's not like using a web server or something. Everything runs in the browser, etc. So, but we keep using these technical terms to talk about what's going on. And the idea of zero data is just a simple way that doesn't require any technical jargon that communicates that the app does not store any data, which is something that people who are less technically inclined are maybe more concerned with than, you know, the architecture or whatever. So anyway, zero data just means the app doesn't store any data, which usually leads people to the next obvious question. Well, then where is the data stored? And so then I can start explaining, oh, you just have to plug in your storage, or you connect your Fission account or whatever. That also needs a better name, storage. I think it's kind of technical, but you know, you plug in your like personal data, whatever, and that's where the data is stored. So, and it's also
data is kind of a strange
Yeah, I mean, data can, data can be abstract, but I think people are kind of concerned about privacy nowadays, or I guess privacy and like
security.
Yeah, like, I mean, the whole discourse about like Facebook not respecting our privacy and, you know, governments have our data. So I think data is a more common word now. Like, I think people understand what data is, at least, or they're concerned about it. You know?
Yeah, I think it is part of the common discourse. Again, I think you're totally right. So, but I actually still think it is somewhat abstract. So I think one of the things our current approach with Fission is going all the way to something that is more tangible, not quite the right word, which is just saying what we mean, which is files, your files, yeah. Right? Which is not always the correct word if you think about like a database or some other things like that. But
now here again, we're getting into this thing about calling it using the technical name, right? Like people, they use apps and services and they don't think about files. They don't know what files are. I think I would bet that people are more likely to know what data is than what files are, but we should, you know.
Interesting. No, that's a really good change. So I've pulled up and I've put the link in there. So zero data app principles, an app in which your data stays with you. You control where the data is stored. No spam, no CAPTCHA, no sign up, no passwords, bring your own identity. Using open protocols for flexibility and interoperability. Do what you want with your data at any time. Your data is accessible forever, even if the app stops working.
Yep.
Great. I think that it definitely, and a lot of that, there's some overlap with stuff that we've talked about before, like local first apps. There's some overlap between some of those concepts in that the one enables the other, right? You can't go offline if you can't actually keep your own stuff around. And your intent really is to use less technical terms, to use less jargon, and to try and explain to people that this is possible. What's your mission with this zero data apps?
It's just to give it a name. You know, if you name this thing in a very specific way, people can kind of look for it, right? For this idea of like owning your data, there's so many different ways to do that. And, you know, you could, anyway, I'm not going to enumerate the possibilities, but like there's no like coherent, like single thing that somebody could, for example, search for zero data apps, and then they know that they're going to see something where they can control the data, and it sort of abides by these different philosophies. So we have this sort of own your data, or we have like decentralized, or we have like and then it's also mixed with these technological things like progressive web app and local first. Sometimes that means you have control over your data, sometimes it doesn't. So it's just kind of giving it a name, making it easy to explain, and also just to have something that resembles like an app listing, you know, like the app stores, or something that kind of looks like, okay, each app has an icon, it has a name, a little description, and there's a standardized presentation. So it looks more approachable. It's just like, oh, these are just apps. I can click on it and interface it. So it's just about making it more accessible, intuitive.
Amazing. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's fair to say that you are, you know, labeling it and gathering these things as part of kind of, building a movement.
Sure.
That is something that you can, you know, send people to list that might not be aware of it. And then they're like, oh, this is what this is like. And they would get in and get deeper and start using these types of apps.
Yeah. Yeah. Make it normal, you know, like for it not to be like a special thing or a technical thing, or it's just something that people can read and they understand and they can look for it. And it's just about naming it, really, and maybe aggregating it in one place, because it's, everything's decentralized, everybody's in their own place. So just
curating.
Have everything
curated.
Yeah. I'm not actually curating at the moment, but maybe if we get some sufficiently large number of apps, then yeah, we would need that. But until then, it's just everything, you know.
How can people get involved?
It's not like an organization. It's really just a page online. You know, it sort of updates itself. But you can make apps that let people own their data. You can talk to people about, or help people use these kinds of apps if you're more technically inclined. Or I think just helping people. There's kind of this gap that we have to cross, I think, with these kinds of apps, because people are, I think, yeah, a lot of people are accustomed to the pattern of going to an app store and then you search for the thing and you download it and you know it's relatively like a safe experience and sometimes you might pay for it, but everybody kind of who uses it understands how that works. There's no, it's kind of a holistic experience. I don't know. It's just a, it's a known pattern.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In this world, there's no patterns, right? It's the web is like every company, every app kind of does their own payments thing. They do their own account thing. Like everything is its own thing. And there's no standardized way to approach this. So that means that people who want to get into these kinds of apps, like it's like every time you use, for every app, there's like a new paradigm to understand basically. And that makes it kind of complex. So if, So we need to sort of help people, I think, just learn how to, for example, put a progressive web app on the home screen of your phone, right? That's a step that most people don't really know how to do that. But if you do that, then it kind of looks like an app, like you got it from the store. Like those kind of things, like they will help people, it'll help people cross the bridge of, you know, this native to web thing. So that's important also.
I think there's a whole bunch of explaining and conceptualizing to do that is important, we almost can't predict exactly what will be normalized, so we try like a couple of different things, right? I think that's definitely,
well, we know what we want. I mean, we're doing all this stuff, right? Because we want, this is kind of the world that we want to see. So
yeah, well, this is more so as an example. I think that was actually Philip was saying. We have folks who are very much, we've got lots of like early Fission apps where we're like, okay, you know, Daniel the other day, asked his sister to sign up, and Philip had his girlfriend sign up, and there wasn't any password, and she's like, wait, there's no password, is it secure? And we're not about to be like, well, let me tell you about private key cryptography as the like step one.
Entropy, right?
yeah. You know, you pull out the whiteboard and be like, well, this is how math works.
Yeah. I mean, so whoever's interested, we can obviously talk about that, right? But I think most people, they just want to like use the app and kind of get on with your life. So.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. So it's not on GitHub or anything like that. Like, how do you want people to like add an app or list an app?
I don't do a good job of explaining that part. So, it's sort of an automatically updating listing. So it's sort of scraping the remote storage apps page and the solid apps page and the unhosted projects apps page. And eventually when Fission has an apps page, we'll scrape that. And so it'll just keep like, the idea is you don't have to like do, I like this concept. You don't have to sign up for an account to do something.
Okay.
You don't have to, you know, so if Fission already has an apps list, then it gets included and nobody has to do anything. So if you want to add a remote storage app, you would go to the remote storage wiki, which is their own thing. And then you add it over there because it adopts the protocol. But I do need to make a separate list for stuff that doesn't yet use any of these protocols. So okay. I might have another repo, but it's not ready yet. So.
Okay. Amazing. Okay. Yeah. So, and you and I have talked about it a little bit. So I think Fission does actually have an app listing endpoint. Probably what I want to do there is make it so that people like fill out a certain amount of information, like a full text name, a description, and sort of opt in into listing into the public list. Yeah. So that'll be a good goal to work on. Brian has actually put together a Fission app that is a generator for the information that you need for a progressive web app.
I think I saw that. Yeah.
So we're going to use that PWA manifest as the like basis for app data because it's basically the data that you need.
I should also mention another interesting thing that I'm doing with this listing. So it's sort of like the first pass is to get it from these listing pages and then it's there. But then I also actually go to each app's homepage, and then if there's metadata there that they've declared, sort of like a name, title, or I should also look at the manifest. But
yeah.
that would also like ideally feed into it. So there's no like form, you know, you just have to like
declare
your data once. And that's how it should be anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Amazing. Okay, so let's, that was a good jumping off point. So we've mentioned a bunch of other things and you mentioned it briefly. So remote storage, that's the main thing that you use today as the main spec that you use.
Yeah, yeah. It's this, for those who don't know, I don't even know how to describe it really. I mean, the technical term is like per user storage protocol. It's a way of like owning your data. You know, you can sign up, you can have a storage account and then you can access different apps just use one account with various apps. So I have, for example, three different apps. One of them is for taking notes. Another one is like around programming and another one is like flashcards. And all of those apps, they use the remote storage protocol for storage, which means that you can just sign in with the same account in all of them. And this account is something that you can control yourself. You can self-host it. It's open source. Like it's kind of, you just have complete control over it. And it's using very common standards. So there's no like, it's not like DAT or BitTorrent or P2P. It's just like HTTP, very standard stuff. And yeah, it's been around for like, I think maybe 10 years or something and not super well known, but I think it's like magical and it works really well. Especially for like an open source project. I think the UX, the user experience, like intuitiveness is great once you get started. Like everything just syncs transparently across devices. And you can also start like without signing in, which I think is so cool, to not ask people to sign in before they try using your app. So you can just kind of show up and you can try things out. And if you feel good, you can sign in with your storage and then it syncs everything. So
yep.
It's a kind of a seamless storage solution.
Yeah, we've got progressive accounts on our roadmap as well.
Good.
Because again, we can do that with some of these things, right? I think it's a good pattern. Question from Philip. Tell us about your flashcard app.
Well, it's inspired by Anki, as maybe the person mentioned. I love Anki. I actually paid like $30 for the iPhone version because it's very useful. But like the interface is like very heavy because it does like a lot, right? And it's an old project. It's been around for a while. So I just wanted something a bit simpler, but also I wanted something that reads the cards out loud with like text-to-speech because I'm really using it for languages. So I just wanted to like not look at my phone and hear the cards and then, you know, make my grade myself, so to speak. So I spent like a month or two just building that out and I got it working with remote storage and I used it to learn Portuguese.
Amazing.
It works, people. It works.
Helder, you're going to have to test him.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to quiz you on that.
So pronto.
How do you say remote storage in Portuguese?
Nossa, remote storage. Almacenamento distante? Remote? I don't even know.
Remote.
Okay, yeah. Armazenamento remoto. I don't know. I'm actually not like super comfortable, but I speak it. You know, I'm very fluent. Like I don't know everything about it. That's all.
So I grew up in Canada, but both my parents are German. So I kind of speak family German, and I cannot talk about any tech things, right? Or I know weirdo versions of stuff. So the like literal word for a computer is Großrechner, which is big calculator, because right. That's just what Germans do.
That's kind of nice. It is a big calculator.
But in reality, everyone just says computer with a K instead of a right. C, because C doesn't right. really hard C doesn't exist. We'll do a German version of a fission. I think we've got enough German language that we can do it. And I'm totally down for doing a Portuguese one. I'll have to do like the simultaneous translation or something. Actually, Brooke, you presented and had your talk live translated into Portuguese, didn't you?
I did. Was it live? Yeah, it was. They had like, I think, a second channel where somebody was just like, you know, with you know, usual interpreter delay. But yeah, I had an interpreter for a talk in Brazil a couple weeks ago.
Were you talking about cryptography?
I was talking about the Elixir programming language.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Huh, that's a fun thing. I'm going to put a note down. I think that's the final frontier in doing some things that are more truly international, is not just doing them in English.
Duh. Yes. the whole technology industry needs to think about that. I think it's really, really terrible. Like, everything's just assumed to be in English. Like, come on.
There was an amazing talk. James was at it too, at Euro OzCon in Amsterdam a million years ago. And it was called the Tower of Babel. And it was a really great talk on how the semantics of English led to, that was embedded in programming languages, led to a certain style of programming. And what would it look like if we had, Japanese, including the characters, being used in a programming language. And at the time, there was a number of like frameworks that were like PHP has bits of English in it, but there was a strong German community that was building some software, and there was a French community. And of course it like looked different and flowed different because the language made you think about stuff differently.
If anybody's interested in these issues about languages and programming, there's a coder named Ramzi Nasser who talks a lot about these issues. And he also created this programming language in Arabic, which is called Qalb, or heart in Arabic. And it's completely like right to left. And there's, but it's a way of exploring this. I'm going to post a link in the chat.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Oh, love it. Okay. So you hinted at a couple of things. We got to commit. I'm literally using your Zero Data app and the screenshot of your brain that is a useful hint for what we're going to talk about here. So let's talk about Hyperdraft.
Should I just start talking about it?
Pitch us on Hyperdraft.
Man, I've been thinking about this for so long. I think I would say like at least like 10 years or since I was in high school, and I'm sort of imagining the system for like writing or whatever. But today's what you see today is essentially like a note-taking app. It just looks like what seems to be become very trendy in the last year, like note-taking apps and like wiki link, double bracket, syntax, blah, blah, blah. Hyperdraft, it comes out of Notational Velocity. I call it a remake because Notational Velocity is this like cult app for Mac for like note-taking, and it's like keyboard oriented and you can search everything really quickly. And it also pioneered, I think, this, or maybe not pioneered, but it did a really great implementation of clicking on links to go between notes. And it was only available on the Mac, and it hasn't really been developed in about 5 or 10 years or something. And there's like an alternative version, which is popular, which is great. But it's sort of like, I think it really needs to be kind of remade. It is being remade, but also again on the Mac. So I wanted to make something that just works on mobile as well, so that I can have the same experience. So I thought it was just a cool project to do it on the web. It's kind of this, so it is my brain in the sense that like I put everything in that app, and like it's how I think, it's how I organize, it's how I've like basically done everything for the last 10 years. Like it's always been in this sort of plain text, writing things down, making lists, linking between notes. Like I've been doing that for like a very long time, but mostly just for organizing myself, like productivity, so to speak. And for years I've just wanted to do this, like I just want to like publish one of these things so I don't have to have like a separate app. I can just write within the same space that I'm used to, and certain things can be public and then I can share them. So I've finally gotten there like this year, where it's this relatively seamless experience.
Last year. It's a year old now, basically.
I published my public space this year, so I'm starting the count now. But, it's been around for a while. I did publish some notes like in the mid of last year, but I think what I published a few weeks ago as my digital garden is sort of a more clear vision of how I think this should be used, like to really get into this non-chronological organization of knowledge and thoughts, and like represent things and however you want, and really like text focused, and the idea that even the structure of the site itself is something that you have to write. There's no interface for creating structure. It's all, everything is just text. And Yeah, I mean, there's like a lot of aspects about this. I don't know how to really describe it concisely.
No, I mean, I think, you know, like my jokey version of this is like, I think there are many of us who have been thinking about this for a long time in different ways.
Yeah.
And there are also a lot of people in the last year to 18 months where this has been like, oh, this is like a thing that you do, maybe 24 months, right? So my jokey version is like, just like Notion, you're raising $10 million next month. That's what we're announcing.
No, but I don't.
So, but I think you have to acknowledge that that, you know, in the same way that you put zero data together and you collect things and you say this is a thing and you label it and it has an ability to grow. I think this note taking. Or flashcards or other, like, oh, Anki, right? Like, so it's a thing that people do. Yeah. And then they can start going like, oh, this one is a fit for me for these reasons, or this one is not a fit for me for these reasons.
Yeah.
And so Hyperdraft is part of the movement of note-taking and gardens. Like you said the word garden. This is me trying to like explain and add, is digital garden is now a term that not everyone knows, but it means it's not a blog. It's not quite a wiki, but kind of a wiki. And I think the garden part is it grows organically. Instead of having a published page that you never go back to, you edit and update it over time. And like a garden, it gets pruned and edited and, linked into each other. I used to, in community wikis I was part of, I actively did wiki gardening. So that was for those who remember early wiki culture in the early 2000s, that was a thing. And I think we're seeing that come back and Hyperdraft fits into that.
Yeah, I use the terms personal wiki and digital garden interchangeably. I mean, it's really just about personal space for writing. And I think the keyword is just like cultivating in the sense that you're trying to like do something over a long period of time. And it's not about this chronological experience of like, what's the latest thing you did. So, and it's great when you resurface old things, like that's almost the point. So,
yes.
But yeah,
I've revamped my site into a digital garden style, bmanconsulting.com. And, what I have found is there are some people who want to subscribe or watch what I'm doing. And I actually made some choices. Like I added a journal section that is chronological. It's like, it's essentially like a blog. But I didn't add a feed for it on purpose. Cause I'm like, no, like you might discover it or I might link to it, but I don't want a bunch of people peering into these notes things so that I know that I can just kind of type whatever I want. So that's one that I thought was an interesting like action, which isn't really the style that you mean. And I think the other part was, I'm like, I actually tried to build a recently updated feed. And it totally doesn't work. And it's a total mess because me editing like 10 things and adding stuff to it adds zero value to someone who's like, Boris edited 10 pages of his brain. Like,
why did you decide to as recently updated as opposed to recently created?
Well, it would be both technically. This was me playing around with even just like how to do this without having to manually add dates, with just files and just like try and keep it super simple. But that's the nice thing about like playing in your own space. I'm not super worried about how other people are consuming it.
Yeah. I personally don't, I'm not against the idea of feeds. Like, I think it would be cool to have some kind of like way for people to subscribe to it. I mean, I don't think everybody should have to do that, but like, it's just another way in, you know. I mean, you see this chronological thing, but then ultimately it gets you into the garden. So
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. A lot of it is kind of UI UX in different ways. Yeah. So Hyperdraft. Oh,
I guess maybe the biggest thing I didn't mention about Hyperdraft is like, there's no files. you don't deal with files. You just like edit notes. And I think that's just so comfortable. Like I see so many people that, I guess they're really into like managing like text files and using whichever app they want. And so I just think that's difficult for a lot of people to like actually think about like what to name the file and like where to store it. Not like it's so transparent. Like you're just editing text. Everything is text. The whole experience is text. There's nothing. that's kind of another key thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very interesting. I had a call this morning with Jeremy Rustin, who's the creator of TiddlyWiki.
TiddlyWiki. Yeah.
His brain works actually in a relatively file-centric way, and he likes the semantics of it. And other people that I've spoken to, it's not the liking of dealing with files. It is the conceptual understanding that they can see their data. Some of the people that I've spoken to. That's, again, it's not everyone. The other half of this, and Jeremy and I partially had this discussion as well, is for those people who are like, I have a phone. I don't have any concept of files. I never manage files. Files just confuse me. And of course, what we're saying is it's both for different users and for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally more invested in that second group of users just because I feel like the first group is already well served. Like there's tons of stuff that they can use, you know. But like people that don't want to deal with technical things, like it would be so great to just help them because I think there's more of them, to be honest.
So it's very interesting talking to me about you know your time in iOS and your time with smartphones. What we're so at Fission, we're working on some account recovery work that we'll actually publish a blog post as well, some technical designs on it, so that we can share how we're thinking about it. And you know, our discovery has basically been that we can actually make this. It'll kind of work all the time for a developer who has a desktop. They'll have a private key on their system. What's that?
What will work all the time?
Fission's account system, which relies on keeping some private keys around. And just like GitHub, you'll keep a private key on your system and you'll be able to link it to different web browsers. And, you know, you might like lose your phone, but you're less likely to lose your laptop. And then, you know, it won't really be a problem. The discussion that we've had is that some people, I've interviewed them and said, okay, you know, how often do you change your GitHub key? And they're like, well, and then they think about how long they have their machine. And they're like, I got this machine 5 years ago. So they're like, 5 years. I'm like, okay, that's pretty freaking safe. No problem. But the use case that we're determined to support as a base case is a person with just a phone and with just a single phone. In the browser, which is especially on iOS, a relatively hostile environment where we're like, hopefully you don't lose local storage. And so we're going to work on that hard use case so that we can serve that base case because that's the users that need the most help, right? They can lose their phone. They can have it stolen. Like it literally is their entire thing. And we want to be able to tell them that like, hey, Fission has your back.
Yeah.
Your stuff will always be available and here's how you can recover it on another device.
I guess this is something maybe I didn't really understand about Fission because I thought if you have a Fission account, you can sort of reset your password. You can get your way back in, but you can't.
Useful for explaining. So a key is created by your browser, whether it's a mobile device or your desktop OS or a desktop browser. That we only have access to the public key. And then, you know, we gather an email address and we have the parts of, hey, we need to talk to you because we provide you a service sort of thing. But your file system, the private part is encrypted and we don't have a copy of the key. So technically this is also how Apple works. There's some other ways where they may have a version of the key. And so we need to design a way, and this is what we're going to post about in our account recovery, to have a recovery code where, again, Fission keeps some things and you keep some things, but we still, by ourselves, have no way to access your encrypted data. That's the design goal, that we never have access.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll post that. That'll probably... It's Thursday already. I'll probably publish that early next week so that we can share that. So Hyperdraft, you built it for yourself. You've pushed it out there. And one of the things on your top of mind brain list is decentralized funding.
So I guess I'll talk about the little funding button that I have in all of my apps. Because I think this is actually quite interesting, this idea that it's inspired by like Patreon, the whole movement to like sponsor a developer or any creator, sorry.
Maker.
Yeah, any kind of sponsor. Yeah, be a patron of whoever your favorite maker is, and you can send them like a monthly payment. So I've been inspired by these systems and trying to think about how to integrate that into this kind of zero data app thing, or where there is no account or there's no concept of like signing up for an account with the app. So what would usually happen, or I guess the traditional way of doing this is like you have your app, and then if somebody wants to pay for it or become a patron or a supporter or something, you would have to ask them to sign up for an account, and then they would make a payment, and then that payment would be linked to some account, and then that would be sort of their way to keep the data together, to keep the data associated with their identity. But in the context of like an own your data app or a zero data app or a fission app, it's like the person using the app already has their account. So it would be very strange to ask that person to then create another account just to do the payment so that you can associate the identity with them and sort of centralize that thing. And it would just be really kind of confusing. So this is like, it's a payment. So I've created this payment system that doesn't require creating an account, and you can still bring your own storage, and you can still have content gating or like unlocking of features based on how much you've paid or whatever parameter you want. So there's all these different parts to it. The first part would be the payment form. So, okay, well, in all of my apps, there's a fund button. So if you click on this fund button, it opens up this modal view, and then it shows you a funding form, which is hosted on another website. That form is where you select essentially like which project you want to support, and you sort of and you say how much you want to give and whether you want to do it every year or every month or just one time, and then that form sends you either to PayPal or Stripe, and then you do the payment, and then you come back to the form, and then the form sends you back to the app, and then the app does this dance with another server, and it sort of unlocks the app. Unlock means that like all of the apps come with this document limit. So I've chosen to make my apps essentially free. Like you can use it for free and you never have to pay for it, but there's like a document limit. So if you reach like 100 notes, for example, like the app will ask you if you can contribute something to the development. And then if you make a payment of any amount, it'll just remove that document limit. And it's done in a way that doesn't store data. Like there's no I don't have a database of payments, like I don't have a database of people's identities. Like it's just taking certain information and putting that in the metadata of the transaction, and that's it. And then you can sort of authenticate yourself and unlock things. This is another thing I need to find a cohesive way to explain this, and I'm going to write like a blog or yeah, some kind of article or math.
So I totally get it. I mean, like, I'm going to unpack like there's a bunch of things in there.
Please. Yes.
Fission will add this to our platform. Like the conceptually the same thing.
What is Fission not going to do, man?
Well, it's a good question, but ultimately at the end of the day, not everyone has a Rosano sized skill set. and so we want
to something to put on your resume, Rosano
stack. The Rosano stack. And so really that's our goal, is that there's certain things that are just easier to do at a platform level or at an SDK level, whether it's so end-to-end encryption is hard, versioning is hard, accounts that are secure are hard. And so we just build them in. And then there's various platform superpowers.
Yeah, I should actually say I totally don't recommend that anybody do what I did. It was so difficult. So somebody really does need to build it. So if it's you guys, great. You know, wish that.
So it's an amazing pattern. Like, I mean, I love seeing this, and I love seeing some patterns, because what we're bootstrapping here, again, naming conceptions, making this stuff less weird for users, making it less weird for developers, empowering people to do these things, right? Like that's what we're doing, is saying it's okay to do this stuff. And we slip into jargon because we have to, because that's the layer where it's still like, well, how did you slam these things together? So a couple things. So one is, let me repeat it. Rosano has a funding button in all of his apps. They're public, they're on the web. You can go there, you can start using it, you can create an account. There's a funding button, right? Brian is gonna add a funding button, right, Brian? Moonforge, which is a lovely app that lets you connect a keyboard, a MIDI keyboard to your browser. That's amazing. So I think that's great. So there's two parts of that. One is explaining to users that they should support apps and pay for them rather than get ads pushed at them. One, right? Like that's the user facing side. The developer side is, hey, you should make the ask, right? You're definitely never going to get supported. And for yeah. me, I'd say like literally the innovation that you have done of having a funding button in the app rather than over here in GitHub where no users go.
Yeah. Actually, this is something I've deliberately, it's something new for me where I've also been inspired by what people are doing on GitHub and seeing other developers and like getting stars and like that. And I realized like I have to like not try to do those things because I'm not, there's something that I don't know how to explain it, but it is kind of like programmer centric. Like the patterns that work for things that function well on GitHub or things that are funded well on GitHub, I don't think will apply to this kind of app that I'm doing, which is not really about developers and programming. And like, I think it's a different market, like a different group of people.
I don't think it's just a different group of people. So at the end of the day, the humans that show up on GitHub are there because they want to like add a feature and they want it green instead of blue. And maybe they want to participate in some other things like that, whether it's a full stack app or not, right? Whereas a user, if they bought into the app, they just want to know that it's not going to go away and it's a different thing. So my current working model is that I want to actually get developers to do this, explain it to users. And there's another piece here of just highlighting that connection between users and developers, where there's an understanding that this is Rosano. He built your app. Do you have a comment? Are you really mad at the app? Well, you're actually mad at Rosano, just so you know. And you'd like a feature, or you'd like it green. And maybe you could say right there next to fund, you could say, I'd really like an option for green. And maybe that surfaces the fact that there's a request for green. And the next three people can see that and be like, you know, a lot of this is like how do you do the UX is really going to influence what happens.
Yeah, I think there's something really important what you're saying about putting a face to the developer. It's something that is very obvious in these other, for example, like YouTubers that have Patreons, right? Like you see their face, you see them talking, they're like, subscribe, contribute to my Patreon if you want this extra special thing. And people understand that that's the person who's doing the thing. And like, so why is it that like when you have apps, it's just there's no person behind it, right? So I think that's a great idea to try and humanize the relationship between the person using it. And also just working out these differences between how a YouTuber would ask versus how an app would ask. Like, I think there is a more, you do kind of have to force it, I think, at some point.
So I agree. I think there's something that we have to learn that is you're like, yeah, I'm a Hyperdraft user. So that I'm learning from things like gaming and other things like that. Like, I don't necessarily resonate with some of that, but that like a badge in the forum. Equivalent, will have some value to certain people. For me, I think it's more like if you pay, you get to participate/vote in feature requests. If you don't pay, like, cool, we want to hear your feedback, but.
Yeah. This is like another thing that's kind of challenging in this space of like the zero data app that only works in your browser. Like there's no network, there's no place where people go to. And I'm trying to like avoid doing that deliberately. Like. Although I probably should set up a forum or something at some point, but right now it's like your whole experience with the app is very self-contained in that one thing. So even if I gave you a sticker, like where would that show up? Like if I just put it in the app, like it's just showing up to yourself.
So absolutely.
That's another thing that has to be worked on.
So there's different things. Like your idea of document limits is really great. So Philip has a question. How do you handle metrics? How do you actually know that your stuff is being used? And like,
you know. I don't. I have no analytics. I have no idea. And I'm not saying it should be not important to everybody, but like, I personally don't really need to know.
I'm experimenting with a somewhat open source. It's sort of an enterprise open core app called PostHog. And it's an area of exploration for us. We'll experiment first in some of the Fission apps, where we probably think what we're going to do is much like Apple does, is we'll basically say to users, would you like to opt in so that we can make the app better, sort of thing. And it, very much product metrics. Right. And again, I think we have to, even without that, that's the kind of thing that we'd love to be able to tell an app developer that 10 users who opted in use the app this week, right? Like
sure.
there's some level of helpfulness in there.
Yeah, I'm kind of a hippie about these things. I feel like, well, if you're just if you just talk to your users, you know, then you'll know. But it's like, I guess some people need the numbers. So
well, I think
the numbers with like advertising, like, oh, we need to know how many people are using, right. So then we can sell ads. But it's not everybody that's doing.
But I think that's exactly it, right? So if you have an invitation to talk, right, so somewhere, sure. Like think whatever that is, like not a funding button, but like talk to me, then you can track that. Right. I think the other half is like, well, 10 people that 20 people used it and only 10 decided to talk to me. Do I need to switch up how I'm doing the wording? Right. Like it's not, I think it's a slippery slope. I totally agree. And it can lead to bad behaviors. And I think the intent is exactly what you said. Let's help developers talk to users more.
Yeah, there was an interesting comment that the developer of Signal, the private messaging app, made. It's like there was some issue about like how people were forced to like identify themselves in some way, and he sort of said like, we have no way to understand how people are using the app because there's no analytics. So like, how do we understand what you want? So there's definitely like something to be worked out there, especially if you're trying to do it in a private way. I don't have any opinions about that, but I agree. It's like something that
you
kind of have to be sensitive.
Helder and I were actually having this conversation a bit this morning, because it like analytics is one of those places where developers often like end up including in their apps sort of begrudgingly, right? Like it was a demand from the client or from their boss or whatever. And we all know that there are like, it's just such a privacy violation in so many ways for like in so many of the current implementations. And I think, you know, from a Fission perspective, if we can do, because the data is super valuable, right? Not just like how many people are using my apps, but if you get into app metrics, like Boris was saying, right? Like you can make, because a lot of app users, it may be great that you offer them to interact directly, but that may not be their relationship with your app, right? But as a developer, you still want to know how they're using the app, because you can make actual decisions about like, was this feature a good idea, or is this feature being used the way that I intended? So like solving that problem, like getting that data on some level in a way that just isn't like screen recording every user's actions, you know, like that I think is a hard problem to solve. And if you know, if there's an option that is as easy to implement as the current, you know, the current options are, like that, I think is something valuable that because most developers don't want to have to put that stuff in, right? Or a lot of us, at least that was our sort of our hypothesis. So yeah, I think there's a real opportunity there for you know, something that gives you that rich data without you know, totally violating users.
Maybe Fission will build that.
Yeah, and so to be clear, like a lot of these things as well, like what we'd rather build is the spec. So I'm really excited to hear about your payments thing. We have a team that's actually quite good at spec writing, part of our team. And it's the kind of thing where we'd love to then figure out how to take what you've built and turn that into here's how anyone can implement it. And here's Fission's open source implementation that is tied into these things. So I think like that's a takeaway. We'd love to do that. I did want to talk about that actually briefly, jargon, because we have some jargon folks in the audience. There's some emerging standards. So there's this thing called verified credentials, and that's essentially what you're talking about. You then have a Hyperdraft paid attribute, or Hyperdraft paid and it's true or false. And that's an attribute that is attached, and it can only be verified by Hyperdraft essentially, but it's also portable. So for instance, if you then log into a fission powered forum that looks at that, you could give someone a badge on the forum depending on their Hyperdraft paid status, as one example of something that's totally portable. You know, and people could use it for different things, and you know, cryptographically, that only the person who gets to say, aka Hyperdraft, gets to say whether or not that's true or false. World. Yeah. This is the same sort of thing, like the this is used in identity. So if for government purposes, Canada, if you need to know that you're over 19 so that you can buy alcohol, rather than passing along someone's birth date, and the BC government is actually working on, they're pretty advanced in this stuff. You'd make a call and basically says, the BC government verifies that older than 19. And that's it. That's all it's a verified claim or credential that says that, which again, doesn't leak data.
I think the other really important thing there is, because it's a credential, you don't have to make an API call. The user can just carry it around with them and reveal just the bits that they want to show people.
Yeah, good opportunity. We'll put this in the notes and look at this stuff, right? Amazing. Other questions? We've talked for a whole bunch. Other people have questions, comments? Okay, I'm going to ask about, so we've talked about your app, we've talked about funding, we've talked about note-taking. So remote storage, we talked about that a little bit. And the model there, I think, is that you bring your own remote storage like provider, and there's a model that they have as well of where if you use a bunch of storage, you pay your remote storage provider. Is that the model?
I think that's, I mean, it hasn't been specified in any way. It's up to each provider to decide. Like right now, the biggest provider or the main provider is fiveapps.com, and they don't charge, I think, or they give you like a gigabyte for free. And but I don't think they've like even a paid option yet. So, but I imagine that would be the case. Like it would be just like email, you know, you sign up for an account and you maybe get some free tier capabilities, and then if you want to pay more. But I think it's just so young that we haven't gotten to that point yet.
Okay. Yeah, and it's something that we looked at where, you know, Fission could technically comply with the remote storage spec.
That would be so great.
Yeah, it's good to know that people are interested in it. It's always tough for us because then we have to adopt someone else's semantics at the end of the day, and they're not.
Open. It's a draft. Like
open. I understand, but semantics, not the actual spec. Meaning in particular that we're pretty committed to having things be completely front end and serverless, and so that restricts us to certain things. We can add stuff at the platform layer, but all of a sudden, if Fission goes away, that could be problematic. So we're interested in it, definitely. And we'd like as much as possible to stick with specs.
Just so I understand, I think what you just said there, is that referring to this idea that the same thing we were talking about earlier, how Fission doesn't like own your, it doesn't have your data, or it doesn't rely on a central Fission server for you to use Fission or to
correct. Use yeah. Apps. As much as possible, we've made stuff portable, you know, ultimately like literally people can run the entire Fission stack, which very few people will do. Brian actually hosts the Moonforge app on AWS, but uses the web native SDK. So people log in and store in their space. Right. So you can kind of mix and match this in a couple of different ways. And we try as much as possible to just everything work in the front end cryptographically, where the cryptography takes care of it. Right. And so where the boundary of our system is that we've integrated it all and it all works out of the box. And we make a bunch of things simpler so you don't have to run them, but that we have goals around it all being portable as well.
Is that goal, does that mean that, for example, you start using a Fission app, and so if Fission goes away, you can still use Fission because it all works in the browser and it's crypto? Is that the ideal?
Yep.
Wow. Very impressive.
Yep. It's hard, right? Obviously, but this is the
I can't even imagine how that's possible, but but I'm glad you're working on it.
Yeah. So Brooke has authored decentralized authentication where you don't need a back end, right?
That's the UCAN thing, right?
Exactly. And then it just sort of goes from there. You know, there's a few pieces where like basically Fission makes sure that your files are online. If it's not like synced into your browser local storage, or if you don't have it running locally, right? So we add a bunch of persistence and we're going to be around and various things like that. But a lot of those things are like convenience and what users expect, which, you know, we know that convenience and what users expect is in fact what a lot of people like. And that's our intent, to just like keep adding stuff where people are like, oh yeah, this is great. I like this deal. I'm in, right? In the same way that you have an iOS account and you use your free iCloud account because it just ties everything together.
Exactly.
Right? If you look actually into Apple settings, they actually let you pick storage on a per app basis, and that's built in. What? Yeah. I'll show you a screenshot at some point. But what people do is, because Apple's done the work to make iCloud the like kind of slickest experience. Like, you can use Google Drive as a backend for a number of things on Apple, but Google has done a terrible job with their implementation, and half the time it doesn't work, right? Like, you can keep your Keynote files in Google Drive. That's an Apple app where you can toggle and say, instead of iCloud, put it in G Drive or Dropbox. A couple of the different storage providers actually do that. And that's, you know, like, that's kind of how it should be.
Yeah, have choice. You
know. But everybody wants to win, right? So everyone, like... Yeah. Other things you have on the list here is Solid Projects. So that's Tim Berners-Lee. Have you done anything with Solid?
I tried, but it's a bit over my head. Like, I think it's using like a different paradigm. Like, it's not just JSON. It's some other thing that I have RDF, to invest time...
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to kind of learn about, I don't know anything about that. So I have to learn before I get started.
Yeah. That was our take too, is that it's a little too complicated for just getting started as a developer. And so, you know, that's another thing where we're like, can we be compatible with that spec? Remote storage is one that's more likely than the Solid.
And also my like lazy test is like, I just want to use the apps that exist and see how the UX feels. And like, I tried like at least like a dozen of them, and I didn't find one that just felt like, okay, like, I really like this. I feel good. Like, it's just like, they're kind of like slow. And I think it's very server oriented. Like, it makes a lot of calls to the server. So there's no anonymous, you can't just like show up and start using it. So I feel like, okay, well, if I have to choose between remote storage and this, like, obviously remote storage is amazing. So I'll just keep doing that.
Okay. And how does Unhosted fit into this?
Unhosted is just the origin of the remote storage spec. Like, it was just
Okay. That's the order of operations. Okay.
Yeah, I think the creator of Unhosted was the original author, or the main spec author. Remote storage came out of that project, which is just a way to get data out of the server and into a place that user can control, and also to just run the app in the browser so that you don't rely on the server. So it's unhosted. Everything happens in the browser, and you plug in your storage as a way to maintain control over the data, and also just to have a consistent experience across apps.
Something I wanted to touch on, and we're timing out here, so I don't want to take this. This has been amazing, by the way. Thank you for talking through all this stuff. This has been really great. something that I've been thinking about, and I want to do some experiments specifically in Brazil, because we have a few folks on the ground, is, have you had an experience? Cause I noticed that you actually, you have, in fact, internationalized, added, the interface in different languages.
Everything. Yeah.
And it's, so Hyperdraft is English, French, Spanish.
I think Hyperdraft is just in English, actually. I mean, I've done the localizations, but it's not like public. So okay. That's the only one, but it's only in English right now. But I always assume that everything's going to be localizable. Like, if you actually look in the code for maps, like there's no language in the code. It's all just like identifiers strings. That point to localized strings. Yeah.
Oh, right. I see. I'm actually looking at the top of Zero Data apps, and that's where you've got French, Spanish,
yeah, Zero
and
Data
Portuguese.
Is like four different languages. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I can actually flip over and... Well, I'd have to learn how to pronounce Portuguese first. Sem spam, sem captcha, sem conta, sem senha, traga sua propria identidade. Helder's like, yeah, sure, whatever. So I can do a pull request and add the German version.
Yeah, if you'd like.
Absolutely. So I was going to say, so that the experiment is what is your take on... like very specifically non-North American, non-Western Europe, we'll use Brazil as an example, comfort level of end users with this stuff.
Of what stuff?
Zero Data apps, using an app on your phone, more or less than elsewhere, right? Challenges?
I can't say I have a super like... informed opinion about Brazil. I mean, I've been here for like a year and I've gotten to know a lot of people. I don't perceive that their comfort with the stuff is any different from any other place. Like, I think at the moment it's equally strange to everybody. So it's just we have to just teach everybody, I guess, like how to get into the stuff. Like, I mean, I have friends in the United States and in Canada and Europe, and I've talked to them about this. And I think it's the same kind of like, what's this storage thing? And like, is it an email address? Oh, it's not an email address. And you have to plug it. Like, it's not obvious to most people that I know, including technical people, actually, I should say. So there are even people who are programmers even, and they're like, okay, what is that? What does that mean? So it's just, I think it's a new paradigm for a lot of people. And this is, it's really like the biggest, maybe like the biggest challenge about turning this idea of like apps as a small business, which you guys are kind of pushing, like,
yeah,
I think a huge challenge is just going to be getting people over this hump of just like understanding how normal it can be once you understand the little paradigms. But I think once people are there, it's like, oh wow, this is really great. Like, it's cool that all my data is on all my devices. We were talking about setting up our friends earlier, and I didn't mention with Commit, one of the things I had done, I had helped, like, I don't know, I tried this with like 20 of my Brazilian friends to help them learn English because it's a huge thing here.
People right. Learning. Yeah.
So I set up a remote storage account for them. I didn't explain anything to them. I just made an account, and then I would just give them like a link that automatically logs them in, because you can do that with remote storage. And I would just, you know, we would like have conversations, and I would just write down the mistakes or words they wanted to learn, and I would make the cards for them, and they would see it show up on their screen. And it was just really cool thing. But I don't even think they perceived that it was about using remote storage.
But they
liked it, and they thought it was interesting. You know, I'm sure it was, they didn't expect something like that from something that's not my Google or Apple or whatever.
Right.
Like, not some huge company, you know. But it's very interesting, I think, once you get there. It's just getting there that's hard.
I think the analogies are going to be interesting again. So app is small business. So for me, that looks like we have a community gardens are a thing here in Vancouver. James making his own sourdough bread at home is a thing. That's an understanding that it can be done at a more local level rather than an industrial process to make your carrots or your bread. And, you know, I don't know what the right analogy is, but it's like, what if same thing, why should software be any different? So the thing that I'd like to do, I think the experiment to do, is to hand people, Helder says homegrown apps. I love it. I've got like three screens where everybody's like riffing on, here's the eight things I want to put on the Fission home screen. I'm like, great.
What is the Fission home screen?
The home page.
Our webpage.
Yeah. Oh, the webpage.
So what I'd love to do is, you know, what is a small app that people could take ownership of, like make their own version, because we're going to build app cloning into Fission, that people could run. I think it's probably content-based. So the thing that I'm thinking of is something like, you know, make a list of your favorite Sao Paulo coffee shops. And it's like, it's the coffee shop recommender. And again, it's like a tip jar, it's a Patreon, it's like whatever kind of thing. Like, that's not even the point. It's like understanding that you could have your own version of this at your own domain. It's not a blog, it's not like a note-taking app, but something that it's just nicely built as a nice theme. And they're like, oh, I can like make a list of X. And what I'm trying to do is, I think, like minimum viable personal app, and then go, oh, it's in Portuguese and it has like Portuguese help files, and I can like ask a question in this forum and Helder will answer in Portuguese and say, oh yeah, you know, just click here. And that's how you make it green.
Right. This is the thing. This is so far in the future for me. Like, I feel like just the idea of like, just you're talking about like, not app developers, but just normal
people.
Yeah, people, right? Yeah. I mean, that's, I love the idea. I feel like I don't know how to make that accessible. I just in my own conception about how difficult it is to like even do programming, just tell the computer exactly what to do and how hard it is to communicate that. It's like I'm very pessimistic about that, but if you succeed, that would be great. I do have like my own opinions about people customizing their
apps too. Please, love to hear.
Which has to do with the Launchlet project, which I don't think we should maybe get into that now. But it's for example, this idea of like, you ask somebody wants something in green, you know, a comment that I've received about my apps is that, oh, it's everything's in black and white, there's no color, right? So you should make some themes. And my hope is that you could just like set your own, everybody will just set their own colors, right? Or everybody will just have the button that they want, or everybody can just use the existing app and just sort of do things on top of it. Because I think the idea of creating a separate app or cloning an app, like that involves like, depending on how you go about it, but it involves a lot of steps. And so the Launchlet project is something where you can just run JavaScript or CSS automatically based on the website or whatever. So I imagine doing something like that, where someone who is at least comfortable with CSS can just say like background red, you know, and then when they use this app, it'll show up in red or whatever.
What I love, Rosano, is that you're doing a really great job of capturing video that I can just say like, this is on our roadmap.
Okay.
So it was actually one of the first things at the dawn of time that Daniel built. We called it the user preferences app, and being like portable and like attached to your Fission account is whether you like want dark mode or not. I know that's in the operating system, but as an example. So very briefly, just to explain to you, is James, who's our senior engineer who's in charge of developer success, is going to be focused on supporting developers, actual developers, and things like Git-based workflows, right? Like that's a thing, it's not gonna go away, people do it, right? What I'm thinking a lot about is designers, tinkerer early adopters that wanna get in a little bit, who are never gonna learn Git. And when I say app cloning, still not the right word, maybe it's remix, maybe it's like reblog, developers do developer things, including updating code, but can someone essentially have this clone where they can start doing more things, including then other people can clone it. And then I think that the super simple starting layer ahead of that really is that sort of like user style CSS, where there's the best thing that we can do there is do a little bit of work on writing down standards and expectations and say, add these classes or do this thing. And then a user can very simply like add this one file an interface that says that they can make it green. Exactly. Because of the way that we store stuff, we can potentially go from, like, literally you've just got the page. What if you made edits with your browser and then you just save them? And then instead of being this original version, it's your version. Aspirational, right? Like, this is like when I say on our roadmap and I say all these things, right? Like, again, some of the stuff, we've got lots of building blocks, and now it's the hard work of like, what features can we do? How do we expose them? Are there standards that we can use? And then more importantly, how do we even explain to people that this is possible?
Right.
We've got a floating funding button, a floating edit this page button, a floating clone button, and then just a big picture of Rosano in the middle that rotates.
Yeah. I guess once you, if your friends start doing these things, then yes. It becomes, you know.
So, and that's it. So that's exactly it, right?
How do you how do you get there, right? How do you, it's that.
So what does someone care about, right? Like, is there a coffee snob or a food blogger in Sao Paulo? I'm picking Sao Paulo because it's gigantic, right? Like, you could kick this off in Campo Santé or anywhere, right? Like, the point is, it reminds me of Flickr, the big photo posting service that started here in Vancouver. There was a meetup group called Van Digicam. And it was early users of digital cameras because no one had digital cameras. And then people bought the first digital cameras. And so they got together and they took digital pictures and they gathered together because it was a thing that was new and you could talk about stuff. And there was some nerdery involved there, kind of thing, right?
I guess, and like, I think Instagram was also like that at the beginning. It was like people would meet in person. They would take, they were like these photo photographer subcultures. Actually, like,
photo walks were a thing. Yeah.
Photo walks were a thing.
Yeah.
Right? Right. So whether it's coming together to work on your flashcards or your digital garden or your launchlets, you know, what is that bootstrap and can we make it, instead of it being at the computer science department with 90% men over pizza? I don't know what the pizza equivalent is in Brazil. Tell me there's some sort of amazing flatbread or something.
Probably still pizza.
I was going to say like the barbecue, but...
Fancy. you know, can we make something that is a little more accessible? Again, this is like, we have to aim for something that we want to see happen, how to do it and run some experiments, yeah. Right?
But I think there's so much... evidence of, like, for whatever reason, like, I'm thinking of the trend that was like late last year with the new version of iOS, where people figured out you could like use shortcuts and a bunch of other stuff to like personalize your iPhone, and the experience was terrible, right? Like, so you would like create a custom icon for an app by creating a shortcut that all it did was launch the app, but then you could assign a shortcut, or you could assign your own icon to it, but it launched the shortcuts app on your way to things. But people were so like desperate to have some level of personalization to make it their own that they would do this. And like in my own house, my partner and my daughter both did this without me ever mentioning it. And it just like, so they could have something that felt like theirs. And I think, yeah, like that's a very strong desire for people. So if you give them that opportunity, then yeah, then it just takes like a little bit of like, hey, did you know, right? Like you can make this notes app, you know, pink and green. And people are like, oh, wow. And what else can I do? So yeah. And then, you know, and then they have to post it to TikTok so everybody finds out.
I mean, I actually think that the remixing of the side-by-side TikToks is amazing. I'm going to say this on video. If you haven't seen it, look for Sea Shanty TikTok. If you haven't been exposed to it, it may sound crazy. It is amazing and it will make your day, the joy that happens there. So I think that remixing of video that is really interesting in TikTok. I don't have an account. I see it secondhand on Twitter. Yeah. Or Mastodon. And then Brian and I were talking about like, oh, there's these great video tools, audio mixing capability on top of that could also be amazing. So making some of these things so they don't feel like technology, essentially, like side-by-side video is actually like, it's hard.
I think it's always just more interesting when it's not like technology, when it's just some kind of interesting, when people don't think about the technology or the app or the protocol or whatever.
And,
it's just,
and they can just be creative, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just be human. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, what a level ending note. We're at almost an hour and a half. So I want to do check. Is there other questions, comments, thoughts that folks want to bring up for Rosanna? Okay, Rosanna, closing thoughts. Other things that you want to whip people into a frenzy and say, go do this thing.
I'm really big on trying to get people to start their own gardens online, because I think it's just cool. One of the things I like about that movement that started last year is it's not really like tech oriented necessarily. I mean, there are a lot of like tech people, but there's just people who like write, you know, and I think that's really great to have this technical movement that's including people who are not technical. So I'm trying to get all of my friends to just have a space where they post stuff that they're thinking about, and can be like, you know, recipes or like books that you're interested in or whatever, just like a space where you just put stuff that you're interested in and sort of represent your way of thinking. Like, I think that's really powerful and transformative and a good example of it's the sourdough equivalent of online, I think.
Right.
Just being an example for your friends, and all you have to do is write. You don't have to do anything technical, especially if you use Hyperdraft, you know, but you don't have to use Hyperdraft, you can use anything. But just getting into that, I think, would be cool. Or if you're technical, like help some of your friends write in some of these tools, because people have things to say and they're kind of either not saying it online because it's too complicated, or they're saying it on Facebook,
platforms,
which means it's going to disappear eventually. Or so just cultivating, right? Cultivating online. So do that.
Well, that's amazing. I will say that I basically want people to do this for selfish reasons, where I'm like, this is amazing stuff. I want to peer into your brain more. And if you put it somewhere, then I can like subscribe to it with RSS. Actually, the other thing to look at is Frady Cat. I'll put a link to that, which Frady is Cat's a cool kind of non-RSS subscriber thing that is pretty cool. That's great. That's awesome. And maybe that's it, is we do a digital garden meetup in Sao Paulo, and I'll pay for pizza.
No, you'll pay for churrasco.
Churrasco. Okay. Amazing. This has been super awesome. I'm going to say thank you. Thank you, Rosanna.
Thank you to all of you for coming and staying. Appreciate it.
I'm going to hit the stop recording button.